geometry is dynamics, symmetries, and statistics in the group field theory formalism. Daniel?
Yeah, here I am. So hello, everybody. Thanks, Bai, for the introduction. And I would like to thank also Jorge for giving me the opportunity to speak. And how shall we say, also Aristide for giving me the opportunity to speak. So slide number two. So the plan of the talk is the one you see on the slide. So I'm going first to give a two, maybe three slides introduction to the group field theory formalism. I'm assuming that you have heard already maybe too many talks on group field theory already, so I'll be rather quick on that. The bulk of the talk will be about the work we've done recently about diffeomorphism symmetry in group field theory. And sorry, let's go back to the previous slide a second. And I forgot to say that all I'm going to talk about is based on the work that I've been doing with Aristide, Sylvain Carrozza, a student here at the AI, Flonea Girelli, and another student here at the AI, Matti Rasaka. So back to the plan of the talk on slide two. After discussing diffeomorphism symmetry, I will leave to the last part of the talk an introduction to a vertex formulation of the group field theory in 3D and some applications of it, and in particular, issue of the braiding and braided statistics in three-dimensional group field theory. Then I will conclude. So slide number three. I think it's very much fair to say that the loop quantum gravity has identified what could be the real fundamental kinematical degrees of freedom of quantum geometry, and also developed many mathematical tools to deal with them. Now, group field theories are, in a sense that I will specify, a combinatorially non-local class of field theories on groups or on the corresponding algebra. And they can be characterized by these two ingredients. So what they do is to bring the fundamental degrees of freedom of quantum geometry, as have been identified by canonical loop quantum gravity, within the general framework of matrix tensor models for simplicial quantum gravity. In doing so, they define, potentially, of course, if everything works, a quantum field theory in the sense of a second quantization, both of spin networks and of simplicial geometry. In doing so, they also offer a tentative definition to the complete dynamics of geometry and topology of quantum space. And the nice thing, one nice feature of the formalists, is that they are almost standard field theories, so methods and ideas from quantum field theory and statistical field theory can be adopted. Next slide. So that's the basic ingredients that I'm going to expand upon in the following are capturing the first four bullet points, the first five bullet points on this slide. So we can interpret the group field theory field, the basic variable of the theory, as a second quantized spin network vertex or a second quantized simplex in the appropriate dimension. One defines a classical dynamic for it and therefore corresponding equations of motion, and a quantum dynamic through a partition function. In practice, the quantum dynamics is defined by the perturbation theory around the phi equals zero vacuum, so the no state vacuum. There's no spin network vertex, there's no simplex in this vacuum at all. And perturbatively, it means that we are expanding around this vacuum in Feynman diagrams, and the theory, each model, assigns an amplitude to each given Feynman diagram. The Feynman diagrams represent possible interaction, or if you want, evolution processes of spin networks or simplices, and they're given by cellular complexes of arbitrary topology and complexity. The amplitude that the theory associates to each of these cellular complexes can be given by a spinform model, is given by a spinform model, or can be equivalently represented as a simplicial gravity path integral. Okay, so this is the, that's the basic idea. From this point of view, so within this framework, the main tasks are the following. So first of all, one has to define interesting models for quantum gravity, which means identifying appropriate actions and Feynman amplitudes that can be of interest for quantum gravity. Understand the quantum geometry of this that is encoded in this action and amplitudes. And in particular, in this talk, I will focus on the issue of symmetries, gravitational symmetries. And then we need a huge amount of work to make sense of the quantum field theory, characterizing the space of states, once more, the symmetries at the classical and quantum level. These statistics that also characterizes the field theory, and then observables, quantum equations of motion for endpoint functions, meaning the Schwinger-Dyson, conserved quantities, and so on, all the ingredients that make a quantum field theory treatable. And then there is a further issue here to make sense of the quantum field theory, which is to understand in more detail the complicated combinatorial structure of the Feynman diagrams, which and the structure of the perturbation theory, which includes a sum over topologies. Yeah, and this can be treated with tools from perturbative normalization of the field theory. And a large amount of activities in the field, in this area, recently have gone exactly in this direction. More further down the line, one would like to define also non-perturbative dynamics, or at least understand a little bit more about it. And of course, if we want to do physics, we have to be able to make contact with continuum and semi-classical gravity and extract new physics. And there are several tentative steps in this direction. I'm not going to talk about all of this. I will focus, as the colors highlight, on each issue of symmetries and statistics. And in doing so, I will say also something about, I will work within the context of a model of quantum gravity. And I will say also something about the combinatorial structure of the Feynman diagrams. Okay, next slide, number 5. So the model I will focus on in this talk is a colored group field theory for 3D Euclidean gravity. The basic variables are 4 fields, and there is a color label attached to the fields to distinguish them with values from 1 to 4. Each field is a function on 3 copies of SO3, subject to the gauge invariance condition you see at the top of the slide. Then we write down an action for this, and we are writing everything in group variables. So as I said, the field is a function of 3 group elements in SO3. As I will specify further in the next couple of slides, the combinatorics of arguments in the action is such that the interaction terms describes 4 triangles with 1 group element associated to each edge, and the pattern of gluing of arguments, identification of arguments in the action mimics the pattern of identification of edges in a tetrahedron, and the kinetic term represents the gluing of 2 tetrahedra along common triangles. Sorry, I said 4 fields, but I mean 4 complex fields. The same theory can be written in a spin network representation using Peter Weyl's function in representations of SO3, and this is very well known. In this representation, you can see that the field is actually representing a spin network vertex. There is a further, more recent representation of the same theory that can be understood as a non-commutative triad representation in terms of continuous variables called x valued in the Lie algebra of SU2 or of SO3. And the availability of this representation is based on a group Fourier transform of the field defined in terms of plane waves as written on the slide. So you define, you use a certain choice of coordinates on the group, so you parameterize the group manifold in terms of an angle theta and a unit vector n in R3, And so basically you write it in terms of Pauli matrices, and you also write the algebra element X in terms of Pauli matrices, so in terms of three coordinates, no, three. The plane wave is given by the exponential of the trace in the fundamental representation of the product of X and G. Now, the plane waves also satisfy a non-commutative product rule that is dual by construction to convolution product on the group. So this means that we have to introduce a star multiplication between plane waves, and this extends by linearity to functions of the algebra elements, so to the fields of the group field theory in the algebra representation. To clarify the geometric meaning of this representation, it's, the first ingredient is to notice that the gauge invariance condition in group representation becomes, by simply doing Fourier transform, a closure constraint for the same x variable. And the closure constraint means that the field is star multiplied by a delta function, by a non-commutative delta function, forcing the sum of the three x variables to be zero. This means that the x variables are associated, that are still associated to the edges of the triangle, can be understood as edge vectors of the triangle in R3. So the field in this representation represents a simplex, as anticipated in the first few slides. The combinatorial structure of the action in this representation is exactly the same as in the group picture because of the duality between group convolution and star product. So I don't repeat the form of the action. Next slide, number 7. So here's what I've anticipated. The combinatorial structure of arguments in the field mimics the combinatorics of edge gluings among four triangles in a tetrahedron. And the field itself can be interpreted as a geometric simplex because of the closure condition, with the algebra variables associated to the edges, or equivalently, group elements associated to dual paths that are on the link, that are the link of the dual spinetal vertex. And the final rules for the theory are given in terms of stranded diagrams that are represented on the right side of the top picture. When you build up final diagrams for the theory, you glue together these three stranded propagators rerouted at the interaction vertices. And by construction, the Feynman diagrams will be dual to simplicial complexes, so in general, gluings of tetrahedra along shared triangles. Now, in one slide, in just one point, you see below the three representations for the amplitude of this theory. In group representation, you have a pure lattice gauge theory form of the amplitude, with the basic variables being the group elements H, associated to paths that go from the center of the tetrahedra to the triangles, the boundary triangles. And the theory forces the holonomy around the edges computed along paths that surround the edges in the dual complex to be trivial, to be the identity. That's the content of the F theory. In spin representation, you get the well-known Ponzano-Reggio spin form model. And in the metric representation, you get what you expect, so you get the simplicial gravity path integral in terms of, for BF theory, so in terms of the discretized triad variables and the discretized connection variables. The action that appears in the exponent is indeed a discrete version of the BF action in 3D. And you can extend the construction in the case of simplicial complexes, that is, Feynman diagrams with boundaries. Okay, so let me summarize the basic points of the formalism. So, group field theories define dynamics for spin networks or simplices, equivalently. The dynamics is defined by sum of all possible gluings of colored, in this case, tetrahedra. And these gluings take the form of a generic complex, gamma, which is the Feynman diagram of the theory, typical Feynman diagram of the theory. And you have to respect that because of the because of the pattern of colors in the action, you have to respect the coloring and the boundary data. And the theory assigns an amplitude to this. Now, the main point that the previous slide has shown is that the spin form amplitudes are exactly dual to non-commutative simplicial path integrals. This is going to be relevant for the following. One can also see that this non-commutative representation corresponds to having used a Duflo quantization map for the phase space given by the cotangent bundle of a group on each link of a spin network state. And this is also the basis for the flux representation of loop quantum gravity that we also developed recently. And if one is interested in understanding a little bit better in a simplified context the role of these non-commutative variables and their meaning, one can consider the case of a single particle or a non-relativistic particle on SO3. And one sees that the group Fourier transform gives the natural momentum representation for states of the particle. The dynamics can be expressed in the same way as we did here, as a non-commutative phase space path integral in terms of this momentum variable. The star product correctly encodes the quantum corrections that you expect given the quantization map. And the semi-classic analysis of the amplitude is simplified in this non-commutative representation, that is, in the path integral representation. The other interesting point that I'm not going to discuss too much, but that will be apparent in the analysis of symmetries, is that in this trial representation of the dynamics, the geometry is really brought to the forefront. So it is useful for the analysis of symmetries, as we will see, but it is also useful to construct models for four-dimensional gravity based on the F-theory. This is simply because the classical constraints can be straightforwardly quantized in terms of non-commutative delta functions insertions in the GFT action, or if one wants, in the corresponding simplicial gravity path integral. And these insertions at the level of the GFT action becomes indeed simply constraints in the BF simplicial path integral. And the translation of this insertion of constraints at the level of quantum states, that is at the level of spin network states, is achieved by change of representation, so by group Fourier transform and then Peter Weyl. And there's been already quite some work exploring this line of research that is reported at the end of the slide. It's mentioned at the end of the slide. So next slide, number 9.
So some questions here, yeah. Daniel. So on this last slide 8, you had this example of particle on SO3. Was it important that it be SO3? Is the fact that it is not simply connected is important, or is it can be SU2?
No, it could be SU2, just that the Fourier transform has been, as I will present it here, and as has been applied in our case, does not take the full SU2 structure into account. So it doesn't keep track of the, if you want, of the hemisphere on the sphere in which you're sitting. You can extend your own construction to SU2, and that's been done by, that's been done by several authors, but I would refer you to the paper by Karim Nui and Jung and Jihad Murad.
Okay.
That, I can give you the reference. Yeah. So you can extend the construction, it just brings a little bit of notation burden.
All right. So the next question is really going back to the basics, namely that in the previously one always took these fields not to be complex, right? I mean, in group field theory, I thought that they were not complex in the earlier versions. Am I just misremembering?
Well, I'm not even sure that I would not misremember. It's just that it doesn't really make any difference from the point of view of the amplitude. Makes a difference on the type of complexes you construct, you generate. And in the literature, as far as I remember, people have been either vague or always said, okay, we use real, but we could use complex, and for what we do, it wouldn't really make much of a difference.
But clearly, there are different theories.
So when you start focusing on the GFT per se and not on the amplitudes, on the Feynman amplitude, then it makes a big difference.
Okay, so if I wanted to get what we know to be the correct 2 plus 1 gravity, I should either use one or the other. So which one is it?
Well, if by 2 plus 1 gravity you mean from Zanor edge, for example, then it doesn't really change anything, because the amplitude for a given compass will be the same. If you really want to define the full filter, including all the sum over topologies, then you have to tell me exactly which combinatorial compass you include, and then it will make a difference. But at this point, I wouldn't be able to say which one is the correct one. Also, from the point of view of what I would say in the following, I would bet for the complex field.
Okay. And the last question is that so far, I mean, you know, we always have, at least most of us have difficulty in understanding the meaning of the perturbation expansion, because we don't understand what physically lambda means. Has that status changed, or is it still the same as before?
Well, apart from the fact that it clearly weighs the combinatorial volume of your space-time, because it comes with the order in the number of simplices that your Feynman diagram contains, besides this, I don't think there's been much more of an enlightenment.
Thank you.
Okay, are there further questions? Okay. If not, then let's move to slide number 9. Okay, so I don't need to stress enough how crucial is the understanding of how diffeomorphic symmetry is implemented in your model if you want to do quantum gravity. So, certainly it's a constraint and a guidance for model building, so for defining the quantum dynamics of your model. And also, if you know that you've implemented correctly diffeomorphic symmetry, it gives a little bit more assurance on the fact that classical GR may be contained in it in the appropriate limit. Also, it can be used in a sort of a reverse role. The recovering of diffeomorphic symmetry can be a guidance in extracting the effective gravitational dynamics in some appropriate corner of your quantum gravity model. In general, for quantum gravity models based on discrete structures, the continuum diffeomorphic symmetry is broken. We expect it to be broken. So what we need to do is to identify some sort of discrete symmetry, some discrete counterpart of diffeomorphic symmetry, either exact or approximate, that acts on our somehow pre-geometric data, by which I simply mean the data we assign at the discrete level to our space-time structures before we recover continuum and smooth geometries. There's been extensive studies on this in Regia Calculus, and I refer to you to the papers mentioned there, in particular by Bianca. And we know that a discrete analog of diffeomorphism can be taken to be the translations of vertices of a triangulation in a local flat embedding in RD. And we know that there is an invariant corresponding to this translation for the Regia action in 3D without cosmodial constant, which describes graph space. But that the invariant is broken and is only approximate in the generic 4D case, and also in 3D with cosmodial constant. However, it is recovered, as it should be, in a continuum limit. And again, this is, if you want, one case in which you use the requirement of recovering different variants to understand how you should recover the continuum limit. And you can also show in Regia Calculus that the invariance of the action is related to Bianchi identities at the vertices of the triangulation. So the closest analysis that has been done on this issue, the analysis that has been done on this issue that is closest to our setting, has been done by Laurent and David Duapre in the paper mentioned for the 3D Ponzano-Reggio spin-form model. Actually, the analysis in that paper has been done at the level of the simplicial BF path integral, and this is what we're going to use. So it roughly goes as follows. So you assume you have a discrete path integral for BF theory, and we have seen that this corresponds to the GFT amplitude for a given triangulation dual to the Feynman diagram in the metric or trial representation. And the action, as I already stressed, that appears in the exponent is a discrete version of the 3D continuum BF theory. And we can identify at the continuum level first, and then at the discrete level, both the local SO3 gauge invariance and then the translation symmetry in terms of SU2 valued scalars, X and phi. And we can also show, and the symmetry is reported on the slide, and you can also show that on shell, so when you use the equations of motion, these two symmetries are equivalent to diffeos. The work that Laurent and David have done was to identify the discrete counterpart of this symmetry. So you can consider the link called LD of a vertex in the triangulation. And it's basically given by a set of faces bounded by links, each face being dual to edges that meet at the vertex. In the GFT language, this link is basically the boundary surface of the bubble that has been studied for analyzing GFT divergences. Then, when the simplicial complex is a triangulated manifold, then the link for every vertex is a two-sphere. Now, you choose an ordering. For any ordering of the edges around the vertex, you can write down an identity that relates the holonomies around the edges that meet at that vertex. And the identity makes use of some group elements that are function of the parallel transports, so of the discrete connection. And you can interpret them as parallel transports between some fixed vertex in the link to the reference vertex from which each holonomy is computed. So you need these parallel transports in order to compare the holonomies and to multiply them together. What Laurent and David have done was to write down in the algebra version, so a projected version of this identity. And this involves some complicated functions of the algebra elements corresponding to the holonomies. I don't need to specify the expression for these functions. Anyway, the formula is the one numbered by one. And one can show that there is an invariance of the discrete action under the translation of XE of each the algebra element associated to the edge being translated by a parameter epsilon and by the algebra element that depends on this complicated function of the holonomies. And this transformation leaves the action invariant thanks to the Bianchi identity number one. Now, the task that we have faced was to identify the same type of transformation, and therefore the same symmetry, and therefore the same Bianchi identity in the GFT formulas. Next slide, number 11. So we need a little bit of preliminaries. So this is, if you want, this is an aside, but it's needed for the rest. So consider the Grünfeld double, which is the semi-direct product of the group algebra and the algebra function on the group. And it's well studied as a deformation of the three-dimensional Euclidean Poincaré group, in which you basically deform R3, the translations, if you want, to the group SO3. So it becomes a curved space. So you can write down a representation of the Grünfeld double on functions on the group manifold. And it's clear that this will be relevant for the group theory setting that is based on functions of the group manifold. And the action of rotations and translations are written on the next line. In particular, one can consider as translations particular functions of the group parameterized by the algebra element, which are the plane weights I had introduced a few slides ago. And if one uses the same group Fourier transform that I introduced earlier, one can see that the multiplication by this plane weight on functions on the group becomes simply a translation on the Lie algebra for functions on the Lie algebra. So up to now, this is just really the analog of the Poincaré transformation for, on functions on flat space. It's just that here we have the algebra that replaces as a non-commutative analog the flat space. The deformation is apparent on when one considers the action on tensor products of fields. And this is because there is a non-trivial co-product for functions on the group, on functions in the group, and it's also written down on the slide just below. So, and this again can be given a clearer meaning, clear geometric meaning by going to functions on the Lie algebra. So if you want functions on your non-commutative space-time, and one sees that one has to translate, one translates the product of two functions. In order to translate the product of two functions on the Lie algebra, one has to translate each of them, but then each of the two functions by the same Lie algebra element epsilon, and then take a star product with respect to epsilon of the resulting functions. Okay, it's also clear from this perspective is that the order of the two functions become relevant. In practice, this means that one needs to upgrade products of functions to tensor products. And in general, this means introducing a braiding map. So it means introducing a rule for swapping elements in a tensor product. The standard group field theory formalism, if we refer already to the group field theory formalism that will be the focus of our attention in the next slide, in the standard group field theory formalism, one assumes that the braiding map, even after this upgrade to tensor product has been done, is a trivial braiding map. Next slide, 12. Okay, so the analysis of symmetry has been done in the paper referenced in the title of the slide. So one sees as upshot of the analysis that the symmetries corresponding to translations of the F theory in a group field theory model are correspond to a subset of the four translations of the Drinfeld doubles in a tensor product of four Drinfeld doubles. So basically, there is one translation available for each vertex of a tetrahedron. Keep in mind that the tetrahedron is the way we represent the group field theory interaction, and is also the number of field colors. So in fact, one can understand the four colors, the four colored fields that enter the GFT interaction as corresponding to the four triangles of the tetrahedron, with the colors therefore labeling the triangles, but also equivalently as labeling the vertices of a tetrahedron that are not contained in the triangle to which the field corresponds. So I will now describe the symmetries that we identified at the GFT level. As a preliminary remark, remember that there was a gauge covariance condition that became closure in the metric representation, and this restricts the available symmetry transformation in the sense that the gauge invariant has to commute with the translation. Okay, I'll skip the discussion of the rotational symmetry, but the well-known rotational symmetry that corresponds to changing frame in each tetrahedron and each triangle in simplicial BF can also be identified in this setting at the GFT level. Let's focus on the translation symmetry that we've seen is equivalent to diffields when some of the equations of motions are used. So the transformations corresponding to diffields are generated by four SU2 valued in the algebra translation parameters, one per vertex of the tetrahedron. Now, let's go back for a second to slide number 7 and give a last look at the pattern of strength in the GFT interaction. Now, if you remove the strength corresponding to the color, say, 3, number 3, then we get the reduced graph that appears on slide 12. This is the portion of the graph corresponding to the tetrahedral interaction that only refers to variables associated that somehow are related to the vertex of the tetrahedron tree. Are you still with me?
Yes, we are.
Very good. Thanks. Now, the translation that relates to the vertex number 3, so the translation of the vertex 3 in some R3 embedding of a tetrahedron, that is generated by the algebra element epsilon 3, acts non-trivially only on the strands of this graph, of this reduced graph. And what it does, again, is clearer in the metric representation. It shifts the algebra elements that were the edge vectors touching the vertex number 3, either by plus epsilon or by minus epsilon, depending on the orientation. Next slide. And here I gave the action of the translation related to vertex 3, the translation of vertex 3, both in the metric and in the group representation on the four fields. So you see that the field labeled by the same color of the vertex 3 is unaffected, and the arguments of the other fields are either translated in the metric representation because they are edge vectors, or you get an overall phase multiplication by a plane wave in the group representation. Now, the transformation can be extended to complex conjugate fields by duality. And the geometric meaning of the transformation, again, is clear. When translating a vertex, one has to translate, one, as a result, translates the edge vectors that share this vertex. The gauge covariance of the translation is also manifest. The shift of the edge variables preserves the closure of each triangle, as you can see by just summing the three arguments of the field after translation in the metric representation. But also in the group picture, the argument of the plane wave is a gauge invariant under left shift, diagonal left shift. So, and then one can show quite easily that these transformations leave the group field theory action, actually even more, the group field theory integrand invariant. Okay, and then one can also show that the symmetry is reducible, because as you would expect, if you have a closed tetrahedron, which is what we have in the GFT interaction, you also have a global translation of the four vertices by the same, all by the same vector, that does not change anything in your theory. It should not change anything in your theory, and that is also true. Next slide, number 14. Okay, now this is maybe the core part of the talk. The rest, I think, it can be read more calm later, or I will discuss it a bit more in a bit briefer form. So let's see what are the consequences, or if you want, the implementation of this, the expression for this symmetry at the level of the GFT vertex in the tree representation of the theory. So in the non-commutative triad representation, one can write down the vertex function of the theory. One has to upgrade as I said, the polynomial in the field to a tensor product, so as to fix an ordering of the variables that appear in it. And okay, one sees that this function resulting from this upgrading is invariant under the translation. And what happens is what I said, so that the symmetry expresses the invariance of the matching condition that force your metric variables to define a geometric tetrahedron. And these matching conditions are invariant under translation of each of the vertices in some R3 embedding. Maybe more interesting could be the less obvious from the action of the symmetry is the result in the group representation. The vertex is expressed, again on the slide, as a convolution of delta functions with given boundary data. And the boundary data define holonomies on dual paths to the triangles on the boundary of the tetrahedron. The invariance of this function under translation again, let me stress that what is invariant is more than the action, is actually the integrand, the very function, vertex function and kinetic function. This is quite a stronger result than in usual field theory. So what I was saying is that the invariance of this vertex function under translation of a vertex tree, for example, means that for any value of the Lie algebra element that parameterizes the translation, the following equality holds, which again means that there is that basically the theory, the function is multiplied by a plane wave with a trivial argument. And the group element that appears in the resulting plane wave is therefore the identity, and is given by the product of boundary group elements as reported on the slide. Now, to clarify the meaning, let's go to the next slide, number 15. Again, the group field theory variables G encode boundary holonomies. And the invariance under translation of the vertex function says that the holonomy computed going on the boundary of the tetrahedron around a vertex, the vertex number 3, is trivial. So the boundary connection is flat. And you can see that this is the same for all the other vertices. This means that what we are imposing at the level of the GFT action, at the level of the GFT vertex, in the form of an invariant under this vertex translation, is, well, what we know to be the Hamiltonian and vector constraint in 3D gravity, so flatness of the curvature, of the 3D curvature. Then one can do the same analysis in the spin representation. One extracts the spin representation of the vertex function, and is recorded with number 2. And one can see that the same invariance of the vertex that was the flatness constraint, basically the Wheeler-DeWitt equation on boundary connection, becomes an algebraic recursion identity for the sigg symbol. This has been studied by Simone, by Valentin, by Etera, and before then it was suggested and studied by John Barrett and Louis Crane. And next slide, number 16. So, in fact, one can derive explicitly this recursion relation directly from the invariant of the vertex function. And it's a rather straightforward calculation, and the result is reported on slide 16. So you see that there is a sort of algebraic Wheeler-DeWitt equation on what is a tetrahedral state. It's a spin network state corresponding to the boundary of a tetrahedron. Okay, next slide, 17. Okay, then one can move on to analyze the consequences of the symmetry at the simplicial level. And here there is one very good news and one not so good news, or let's say partially good news. So the good news is on page 17, on slide 17, and the not so good news or partially good is on slide 18. Don't go and look for it now. So on slide 17, we have seen already the form that the translation symmetry and the Bianchi identity take in the projected Lie algebra elements for the holonomies, in terms of the projected Lie algebra elements for the holonomies. And one can see in a very, very straightforward way that the same quantity can be seen as the Lie algebra projection of the translation symmetry of the GFT in terms of group elements. And basically you're acting on your amplitudes by multiplication by plane waves. And then you're collecting the terms together. And so this can be done, and one can even show a bit more clearly, well, at the same level of clearness, I would say, the geometric meaning of the group elements that go and twist the translation parameters in obtaining the Bianchi identity, the resulting Bianchi identity. Okay, now slide number 18. What one would like in this group field theory setting, once one has identified the relevant symmetry to be given by a quantum group, which is some subset of copies of the Drinfeld double, would be to derive the Bianchi identity, as we have done in a bit more geometric fashion in the previous slide, from the GFT amplitudes directly and in a purely algebraic way. So in this, what I mean by this is, suppose I have no idea about the geometric meaning of the Feynman amplitudes. I only know they're constructed in the field theory that I've been given. And I have no idea about Bianchi identity. But I know that I have a symmetry, and I know that my amplitudes have to be invariant. So to derive the Bianchi identity from the invariance of the amplitude entails basically writing the group field theory amplitudes in a more general framework of braided quantum field theory that is appropriate for studying these quantum group symmetries, and that has been developed by many people, in particular Robert Eckel. And basically one has to do the following: write down the amplitude of a GFT, a graph of a GFT, in the form of a diagram, of an ordered diagram as in the second picture in the slide. So they want to really keep track of the ordering that has been chosen when upgrading the product of fields as functions to a tensor product. And then one wants to separate the loops. And this is because the amplitude for the group field theory is expressed in terms of contribution coming from each loop around each edge of the triangulation. So the diagram that I've drawn on this slide, that I've reported on the slide, is the is the contribution from the full Feynman diagram of the GFT to a single vertex. Basically, this is the diagram for a single bubble dual to the vertex. And I'm saying that one has to take this diagram, write it in terms of a tensor order tensor product, that's the second step, and then swap the loops, swap the strands, in order to separate the loops. This swapping requires some understanding of some sort of a rule for crossing and swapping strands in this bubble diagram. And the not-so-good news is that we've been able to identify such a technical rule only in one simple case, which is, by the way, the one reported on the slide. However, from the general structure of the theory, we expect that such a swapping is possible with the result we report for this example for all spherical diagrams. So for all the diagrams of bubbles that can be written, can be drawn on the surface of a sphere, basically, or if you want on a plane. That means that it should be possible to derive, in this context, the Bianchi identities in a purely algebraic way, for only for diagrams that are manifolds, that are dual to manifolds, Feynman diagrams that are dual to manifolds. In general, we would expect that the Bianchi identity would be broken, or at least modified, for non-manifold diagrams. And the reason is, can be traced back to the fact that I reported at the very beginning that in the standard GFT formulas that we are using here, the braiding map is chosen to be trivial, the braiding between two fields, two GFT fields. This trivial braiding does not intertwine the GFT diffeomorphic symmetry that we identified. And the reason is that this symmetry is a quantum group, again. So this means that that a priori, the symmetry is, well, almost certainly the symmetry that we identify will be broken at the full quantum level. In particular, the GFT endpoint functions are not covariant if one uses this, related to this quantum symmetry, if one uses a trivial braiding that is a trivial statistic of the GFT fields. Next slide, number 19. Okay, so that was the core of the talk. Now I'm going to tell you some steps in addressing this issue and in the process obtaining some other interesting results. So the analysis of diffeos, of GFT diffeos, suggests that the fundamental degrees of freedom, at least for this three-dimensional colored group field theory, are actually associated to vertices of the triangulation, not edges of the triangulation. That's where the symmetry transformation acts. Moreover, if I want to do for GFT what I usually do in a quantum field theory, which is to define my field theory in terms of representations of my symmetry group, in particular define my field in terms of the representation of my symmetry group, then they better be expressed more naturally, at least in vertex variables, because that's where the symmetry group identified acts naturally. The step from a field expressed in vertex variables to a field represented in vertex variables is rather straightforward and is reported on this slide. So you go from a field phi, the one that we had in the previous slide, whose arguments are associated to edges of each triangle corresponding to the field, to a different field psi, whose arguments either in group or vertex variables, or sorry, either in group or non-commutative algebra variables, are associated to vertices of the same triangle. And this is a clear geometric meaning. You can describe a triangle, a geometric triangle in R3, either by three edge vectors that close, or by giving three positions for its vertices up to translation, up to a global translation. And in fact, one can see that the group field theory diffeo we identified acts very naturally on this vertex variable, as one would expect. Next slide. Using this field, one can also rewrite the action, the same group field theory action given earlier in terms of this new field, so in terms of these new vertex variables. And besides the technicalities, one notices a very interesting fact, that the vertex function now is a different combinatorial structure, because it has to represent the pattern of identification of vertices among the triangles. And from the point of view of a Feynman diagram, it really looks like phi to the 3 vertices for a quantum field theory on the Lie algebra. Take 1, 2, 3 seconds to look at the vertex diagram to realize that this is the case. Slide number 21. So, starting from this action, one can rewrite also the amplitudes of the model in these new variables. And what is clear is that already at the level of Feynman diagrams, you are going to see a different combinatorial structure. And one example of a simple Feynman diagram taken from the paper cited above is reported on the slide. And what happens is that you can identify, if you look at each color, you can identify a subgraph of the full Feynman graph, which is really the Feynman diagram for a non-commutative phi to the third scalar field theory on the Lie algebra. A non-commutative field theory, because the Lie algebra is a non-commutative space. Then one can also notice that each of the sub-diagrams is dual to a triangulation of the boundary of the bubble around the vertex of color L. So it fully captures the topology of the bubble. The overall amplitude is given basically by this, by all these graphs for each bubble, glued together through propagators. So there is both a local information, whereby local I mean at the level of each bubble, at the level of each vertex of the simplicial complex, and then a more global topological information about the full simplicial complex. And this is reflected in the quantum amplitude reported below. Again, it's not important to understand the detail of the formula. The point is that you see a nice factorization of the amplitude into a contribution on the left that sees the structure of all the bubbles of the diagram, and a function on the right, which basically corresponds to gluing these bubbles together. This bubbles plus gluing factorization is very convenient for analyzing the divergences of the theory. Okay, I just report one example of a result we got that amounts to finding some bounds that are proven optimal, that show how pseudo-manifolds are suppressed as compared to manifolds in this theory. Next slide, 22. Okay, so let's see if this vertex formulation helps in analyzing the grading issue in group theory that we've seen is crucial in the model and in the full implementation of the diffeomorphism symmetry at the group field theory level. So one aspect, once more, that because diffeos act on vertices, this parametrization of the field theory is of the GFT is also convenient for studying the issue of grading. So let me change slightly the notation for colors. Instead of using one color label for the vertex opposite to the triangle to which the field psi corresponds, we use three colors for the three vertices that belong to that triangle. I hope the notation is clear. Then one can see indeed that if I translate a vertex color by C, then I simply multiply the field by a plane wave if that color is contained in the triangle, if that vertex is contained in the triangle. Otherwise, the field is unaffected. So this is what we've seen already before. It's just the expression is much easier because we directly work with vertex variables. Then the task is to identify a braiding map among group field theory fields that, on top of being well-defined, intertwines the group field theory translation. And the equation that states that the states this intertwining property is the one reported. Because we are very smart students here, and also thanks to some previous work we had done with our colleagues, then we identified this braiding map that satisfies this intertwining property, and I report the general rule on the next line. Again, it doesn't really matter the explicit form for now. The message is simply that one can find it and write it down in a compact, well-defined form. And I also show an example in the final equation of the slide. Now I leave you 1 second, and then we move to slide 23. Okay, there's no need to go into any detail about all of this, also because this is work in progress. The point is that one can go back to edge variables and deduce a more complicated grading for fields in the edge variables. And one can notice that this is simply the natural grading map inherited for group field theory fields from the representation theory of the dream field double. So it's a very natural construction from the mathematical point of view. And then again, one can show that this grading intertwines the translation symmetry of the GFT, which means that now, if one uses this braiding, so defines a braided group field theory formula, which is just a simple extension of the earlier one, of the previous one, then the endpoint functions are now fully covariant at the quantum level. And this has further consequences. One can also go beyond and interpret actually each field, each group field theory field as a tensor product or representation of the dream field double, and also define a braiding map that basically corresponds to the transformation properties of the field and the permutations of the argument. Okay, again, I don't want to give more details on this beside this main message. The point is now the stage is really set for a purely algebraic implementation and derivation of diffeomorphism symmetry and Bianchi identities at the level of the group field theory amplitudes. Beta, they are already implemented, but now they can be analyzed in a really purely algebraic language. And now it makes sense to study the word identities for endpoint functions, given that now they are covariant under the symmetry. And also, what we are defining really is a statistic. A braided statistics for group field theory states. That means for group quantum gravity spin methods in a second quantization, so we can really go ahead and construct the Fock space for the theory and rewrite the dynamics in this formula. So concluding slide 24. So to summarize, the group field theory is defined, as I said, a tentative but a priori complete quantum dynamic for spin networks or symplices. just as you can do in loop quantum gravity, they can be written in three main representations. And of course, in, you can keep changing variables after this. But these three representations are somehow more clearly distinct than others, I would say. There is a non-commutative triad or flux representation, a connection representation, an spin network representation, which corresponds to writing the same states in terms of quantum numbers of some geometric operators, area and volumes, as we know very well. These spin-form amplitudes are exactly dual to non-commutative simplicial gravity path integrals. By dual, I mean that they carry exactly the same information, except that, as always in different representations, you may decide to highlight different subset of this information. As I mentioned but didn't expand upon, in this representation, the construction of 4D gravity models is transparent, at least at the geometric level. And the main point of this talk was that one can identify the group field theory analog of the simplicial diffeomorphic transformation. And as a consequence of this, we have seen that the group field theory symmetry makes possible to relate very nicely, I would say, the consequences of different variants on quantum geometry. So you can relate simplicial vertex translation as analyzed, for example, in Rege calculus, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation on cylindrical functions in the connection representation, and the algebraic recursion relations for spin-form amplitudes, or if you want, for spin networks, for some spin network states. And one can also elucidate the GFT origin and the role of the Young identities. A crucial point was that these group field theory transformations corresponding to simplicial diffeos are quantum group transformations. So they naturally suggest an important role that should be played by braiding and braided statistics in group field theory and therefore in quantum geometry. The appropriate braiding, at least for the model I considered, can be identified. As an outlook, well, I mainly repeat some of the things that were on the previous slide. These are really the first things down the line. One can clarify further and complete the algebraic characterization of Bianchi identities. Then one has to really take seriously the braiding structure and reanalyze the group field theory amplitudes, in particular in their dependence on the topology of the Feynman diagram. And one can analyze the scaling limits again of the theory. As I said at the very beginning, a considerable amount of activity in the field recently has been devoted to understanding perturbative GFT renormalization, the way the amplitudes of the GFT model capture the topology of the diagrams, and defining what is the group field theory analog of the large n limit of tensor of matrix models that is crucial for relating matrix models to discrete and continuum gravity, and to show the emergence of simple topologies from the sum over topologies. And this has been achieved by Razvan for this large n limit, and there's been lots of very nice work by many other people, Joseph and Valentin and the Paris group and some people here at the AI. Then further down the line, as I said, the next thing would be to study in more detail the world identities and conserved quantities following from the group theory symmetry at the level of the endpoint functions, that is the spin network state. That take into account the full quantum dynamics as formulated by the GFT. And this dynamics is encoded really in the GFT Schindler-Dyson equation. And then I mentioned that the concluding point, in a sense, of this part of the analysis would be to define the full Fock space of GFT states and therefore loop quantum gravity. Related to this and possibly influenced by this, but further down the line, is to extend all this analysis to the 4D gravity models and see how diffeos are broken as we expect, but most importantly, how they can be recovered, in what limit they can be recovered, because this recovering will suggest what is the right regime in which to recover continuum geometrodynamics from GFT, and the role of braiding in all this. And of course, there will be much, much more. So next slide. Let me thank you for your attention.
So a time for questions, discussion.
This is Carlo. I have a question. Daniele, can you hear me?
Yeah, ciao, Carlo.
No? Ciao, Daniele. It's a very simple and natural question, and the last thing you've said when you look ahead towards the four dimensions. It's in particular, if you think about your way, nice way of dealing with diffeomorphism in 3D, the first thing one want to notice is that it's very much tied to the fact that 3D the diffeomorphism in 3D have this property of being attached to the other symmetries in the way you say, which doesn't go through in 4D. So how much, did you see ways for using this, did you see reasons for thinking that something similar could be meaningful in 4D, and what are these, eventually these reasons? Yeah.
Okay, so I tell you what I think, then you judge the reason. We know from simplicial gravity that also in 4D, the discrete analog of continuum, the most natural discrete analog of continuous distance are vertex translations. And we also know that in a generic quantum gravity theory in 4D, at the discrete level, they will probably be broken. That is the reason for why I wrote the last sentence, the last line on the slide, so the last but one. What we do expect is that there will be, in 4D VF models and edge symmetry, we already know that that is broken in all the existing 4D gravity models by the very impositional simplicity constraints. Now, there will be two questions. One is at the GFT level, not necessarily at the level of the GFT amplitudes, is there an invariance of the action of the GFT, not necessarily the function, the interaction function, the action of the GFT that corresponds to vertex translation that is not broken? And if it is broken, if there is one but it is broken, if there is such a transformation but it is broken, then the question is in which regime to recover it. It's not obvious that it should be broken at the level of the GFT, because in principle, GFT, although it's formulated in terms of completion data on the boundary when you consider polynomial observables, it sums over all possible diagrams. So somehow it captures, in a way that we do not understand at the moment, the full continuum information.
So, just continuing on Carlo's question, which is really that if I just look at the continuum theory itself, then I know this old work that was done in loop quantum gravity for 2 plus 1 gravity, three-dimensional gravity, we know that that we can write, we can just look at gauge transformations, which don't refer to any diffeomorphisms, but because the triads are also Lie algebra valued vectors, given any infinitesimal generator of the gauge transformation, I can get a vector field on the manifold by just contracting the generator with the triad, and therefore the two are related to each other. Now, in four dimensions, no such thing happens in the continuum. So is your viewpoint somehow that even though this does not happen in the continuum, somehow life is better in group field theory?
Yes, something that we do not expect is that the relevant symmetry that are associated to vertices of 4D complexes will be parameterized by SO4 or even SU2 Lie algebra elements. That is certainly cannot be the case, because they cannot be interpreted geometrically as translations in 4D.
Right, that's exactly what I'm saying. So
in this sense, okay, if this was the question by Carlo, then maybe I misunderstood what the question was. That this we do not expect. What we expect that we could be able to find is vertex translations generated by four parameters, by elements that affect the variables of our fields, by vectors, fluxes, or functions of them, that are that depend on four parameters. So in this sense, they are not Lie algebra valued.
But somehow then one would declare them to be analogs of diffeomorphisms, even though in 2 plus 1 there's a clean relation to really identify the generators of diffeomorphisms with generators of local gauge transformations. In 4D, we don't have that. Now you're saying that, well, in group field theory, there will be some four-parameter...
But in this context, the symmetries I'm referring to are always the simplicial differences. So I know how to make contact with simplicial gravity at this stage of understanding. And so I'm referring to what we know about diffuse in 4D simplicial gravity. Indeed, it's a much more difficult problem. I don't really know what the relation will be with the continuum diffuse in canonical Lie quantum gravity in 4D. That is true. I do not have at the moment an understanding of what I should expect from that point of view.
Other questions, comments? Okay, let me ask a very general question. Okay, go ahead. Carlo or somebody else?
Yeah, that was Carlo again, but go ahead if you have.
No. You want to continue on this along the lines? Or I'm changing the subject. So. Okay, so let me change the subject slightly. And just for people who are not experts in this thing, right? So one might say that, well, we knew, given any compact topology, we knew how to do 2 plus 1 quantum gravity using loop quantum gravity techniques. And so you don't have to go through Chern-Simons. We can just live with just completely group loop quantum gravity. And then we know what the physical Hilbert space is. So we know what the states are. Therefore, we know what the inner product is. Now, as I understand it, the whole point of this transition amplitudes and so on is to really extract solutions to the physical states from kinematical ones and give them in a product. So if that is the case, then in some sense we knew this before. So two questions. One is, do we have an agreement that we get the same answers as before? Were the old answers incorrect or incomplete in some sense? Or is the viewpoint that we are just reproducing the old answers in this language because this language may be better suited to further generalizations? I'm a little bit confused about what the global viewpoint here is. In other words, we already know about 2 plus 1 gravity, loop quantum gravity, and therefore we can use it to learn about group field theory. That is one viewpoint. The other viewpoint would be, no, group field theory is telling us something quite new, even in this particular context. So we're learning something about 2 plus 1 loop quantum gravity from group field theory. So which is which is in the three-dimensional context?
Okay, just to cover. First of all, I'm not sure what the global point of view is. I'll tell you mine. And the second one is that I think that the two perspectives you mentioned are not at all in contradiction. I mean, I think that both cases are true. Yeah. We should actually use all that we learned already from loop quantum gravity to understand better group field theories and vice versa, and check what group field theories, because they are a different implementation of possibly the same theory, can tell us more about loop quantum gravity or in addition to loop quantum gravity. Then there are two points concerning what we could be learning more. So one thing is that in that definition, group field theories come with a prescription for the sum of the topologies. So that is something that we would be interested in understanding also in a loop quantum gravity context, and I'm not so, even in 3D, and I'm not so sure exactly what the results are. So you can tell me about that. And the other point is that, as a very practical point, at the moment, a good deal of activity has gone into the formulation of the dynamics for 4D loop quantum gravity in a spin-form context, and I do not know of any other complete definition of such spin-form dynamics that is not a group field theory. So at the very least, we have somehow the necessity of understanding some of the GFT structures if we want to progress along that line. And then one additional ingredient that we can bring in loop quantum gravity, thanks to the group field theory setting, is, if you want, the one of the points I make in the very first slide, I think, which is that we're also making contact with a bunch of techniques, ideas, and mathematical tools that have been developed in matrix models. In particular, that is, of course, is a much simpler context than either 3D or even worse, 4D quantum gravity. And then we see that the quantum field theory treatment of the model tells us that the geometrodynamic equations of motion, so the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, can be extracted from the Schwinger-Dyson equation for appropriate classes of endpoint functions of the matrix model. So one thing that we should do in order to make contact with the results on the physical space of loop quantum gravity is the one I mentioned here, which is to study the Schwinger-Dyson equation of the GFT. That is the full quantum level. If we don't go to that stage, then it is true that probably group field theory cannot tell us that much about more about loop quantum gravity.
Thank you very much. Other questions or comments, please?
Maybe I can go to the question I wanted to ask before. There's another notion of diffeomorphism on a discretization of gravity. If you take a four-dimensional triangulation or a two-complex, just so the fixed structure of your Feynman diagrams without the labels, then this may have a symmetry. I mean, the two-complex have a group of isomorphism, maps from the faces, edge, and vertices of the two complex to themselves that preserve the two complex structure, the boundary structure. And so this is a completely discrete notion of diffeomorphism. And somehow, if one takes the continuous diffeomorphism of the manifold and discretizes the manifold, the remaining maps from manifold M, from M to M, that preserve the discretization are those ones. And this is something else from the ones we were talking about, it seems to me, no? And they don't refer to moving point around, and they are there also not around flat space. They are there generically. There's nothing to do with flat space. Now, from this perspective, if I have a discretized geometry, so now if I have to two complex with variables that represent the geometry, your variables in any representation or others, then I know what a discrete diffeomorphism is because it's just a set of variables which is mapped by this map from the two complex itself in a different set of variables. I also know what is an isometric diffeomorphism if they're mapped into themselves and so on and so forth. And I believe this comes in naturally in group field theory, if I understand it, because in a sense, when you are, since you're doing Feynman diagrammatics, Feynman diagrams you have to divide by a combinatorial factor, which is the number of symmetries of the Feynman diagram, which essentially is the dimension of the remaining diffeomorphism group in some sense. So it's not absent this idea. Now, I was wondering if your diffeomorphism has anything to do with that, and if you think that these are not related to the diffeomorphism of generativity, or in other words, it seems to me that in a background independent theorem, the diffeomorphism are the maps of the object into themselves that preserve the structure more than anything else. So, what is the relation between these diffeomorphisms? And also, perhaps I wanted to add a little comment. I think that group field theory is a very nice and very powerful way to define the full dynamics in the context of speed forms. But I would not agree with what you said is the only way. There are other ways. One can simply take the limit. There's appropriate notions of limit of refining a triangulation which might be related to group field theory or might not be related to group field theory. I think it's an open question, but it's not the only one. I just wanted to stress that. But the question was about the different morphisms. What do you think?
Yeah. Okay, so there were many points you were making. So just because it was the last one, I comment on the last one first, and then I try to recollect the other points before. So on the last point, it is true that as a matter of principle, you can define a refinement limit. It's just that, well, I've not seen any any calculation done in that context using that refinement limit, and I'm not even sure that physically is the procedure you would want to apply. If you start from if you try to define refinement limits, I would rather take the type of cost-graining effective dynamics approach that Bianca has been doing for in simplicial gravity path integrals, also for spin forms. We have said that they are basically equivalent.
No, anyway, I'm not referring to.
This is a matter of taste, I would say, but okay. I'm aware that there are other opinions beside the one I expressed. Then all the other comments and I think questions were about the other possible notions of diffuse. Indeed, the one that you mentioned that is purely combinatorial is, for example, the definition of diffuse that is used and implemented and argued for in dynamical triangulation. And in some sense, it's exactly complementary to the one that is used in Regge calculus, just as the two approaches are in many ways complementary to one another. I'm not sure if there is any direct relation between the two. At the moment, I couldn't think of any. And it's also possible that an interpretation of the transformation we found and that are found in Regge calculus has to do more with embedding the complex into some ambient space. So yes, I agree with you that there are other notions of diffuse, and I also agree with you with the point that you made in a more tentative form, which is that also this other notion of diffuse, the automorphism group of the simplicial complex, is taken into account and present at the GFT level. Because in fact, when one writes down the Feynman diagram, one has to mod out by this symmetry group. And one does it, in a sense, automatically in this quantum field theory setting. The only point I would like to notice is that, yes, they are both present, but this second notion, this purely combinatorial notion, I don't think we can upgrade it to a field transformation in any sense. That means I'm not so sure how many consequences it has on the field theory and on the dynamics of the field theory, at least in this GFT context. If I missed some of the other points you made, please make them again.
There's another question from here.
Hi, Daniel. This is William Melson of Penn State. So,
hello.
As I understand it, the group field theory approach is that you derive a Feynman diagrams via a perturbation theory around a no-space state. So does that mean to get to a continuum theory you'd need a non-perturbative version of the theory, or is the continuum theory somehow different?
Well, the full theory is in the partition function. It doesn't really matter how you define it. So if you're able to do the full sum over Feynman diagrams and consider arbitrary complicated boundary states constructed out of the no-space vacuum, that would be just as good as any other definition. It becomes a practical point, but of course it has a conceptual implication, that if you're interested in non-perturbative configurations that basically capture highly complicated spin networks or the physics of many degrees of freedom, of many of the degrees of freedom that label spin networks in the usual definition, then yes, you should go to different vacua and develop effective dynamics around different vacua. And this is what we and other people have been doing in some recent work in very, limited, with very limited means and in a very tentative spirit.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Other questions, comments?
If not, let's thank Daniel again.